Hello, everyone. Hopefully you're having and or had a wonderful day today. If you're new here, welcome. This is Beyond the Garment with me, your boy, Drew Joyner. And today we may have the best episode that I've ever recorded on this podcast. We've done this for 4 seasons, and I would say that this is a Hall of Fame episode for me. This is a top tier episode. I'm very excited about it. Before we begin, if this is your second time listening, make sure to give us a 5-star review after this episode or at any point during this episode. If you're listening and you're like, damn, there's some good gems of knowledge, of fashion, creativity, thought-provoking thoughts, whatever it may be, give us a 5-star review. It would mean a lot to me. Today's guest is one of my all-time favorite style influences. Jason Jules is the co-author of Black Ivy. He is one of the most beautifully creative individuals that I've ever come across. And in today's episode, I of course ask him all about what inspired the book, Black Ivy. But we also get into identity, his upbringing in East London, and he recounts a very, very cool moment with Tyler, the Creator. All of that and more coming up ad-free and crispy for you in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Let's roll the tape. But that's exactly what how I wanted to get things started anyways, is I just want this to be a super relaxed, impromptu conversation between two dudes who obviously care a lot about fashion, for one. I look up to you in a lot of ways because of this beautiful thing that you've created, Black Ivy, but also for other things. I've known about you for quite some time, and it's just been kind of like a big goal of mine when I started this podcast. I knew that I wanted to have you as one of my guests, man. So,
thank you. Because to be honest, when I started seeing your podcasts, it's like, you know, you have certain kind of goals. Like each year I have a goal. It may be completely absurd, but I have a set of, you know, by the end of the year I want to have done this sort of right. stuff. So when I was looking at your podcasts and your posts, I'm like, yeah, it would be really good to talk to this guy.
Oh, man.
Because, for one, because of your enthusiasm and your interest and your openness in like discovering stuff. Yeah. And to be honest, seeing stuff through your eyes makes me, even if I've already, like, you know, I'm into denim, yeah. but I'm learning stuff from you. Do you know what I mean? Like,
Don't tell me that.
I assume I know it all. I can assume I know it all. But then when you go around discovering stuff and you're entering this kind of first story in New York and you're pulling out these new things, like, wow, okay, this, I need to keep watching this guy. Maybe if I get the chance this year, you know, even if I go to New York and like, I just call you up or something. That was how it's working in my head.
I was, so, well, when you get to New York, because I know you're down in Paraguay right now, whenever you get to New York, please let me know. I would love to coffee, bagels, dinner, lunch, whatever 2-minute conversation on the subway, does not matter. I would love to entertain in that in some way. And thank you for that compliment as well. I try to approach things with a fresh perspective. I try to, because I'm not someone who's, you know, traditionally trained in the fashion space. Right. I kind of posture as an expert. Some people see me as an expert, but I'm really a novice looking to learn and tell people the things that I learn about along the way. And sometimes there's information that I get that, okay, it's 80% there, but I'm missing 20% of something that's important. And that's still part of like the journey and the process of telling that story. But yeah, with denim, I've been loving that.
I think that's part of the strength.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. I think that's part of the strength, to be honest, because when you're, what was it like? You were responding to somebody who was talking about you having more than like a handful of pairs of jeans, and I was like, number one, this is your work. Number two, you're enthusiastic about jeans. And then I think I kind of posted a comment saying, you know, when I used to work with Jamiroquai and they were telling him about, you know, him having so many cars, mm. like he was into sports cars, and his response was, you can only drive one at a time. You know, you can only wear one pair of jeans at a time. So why is everyone freaking out?
No, that was a...
You know, and if you're into those clothes, then go for it.
For sure. And that was a moment where I was like, I think people misunderstand the difference between... Because I think people see me and this is a lot for a lot of creators online who post videos online, talk about fashion online, they see the person they're viewing as the same as them, which we are we are the same as everyone else, right? But the difference is that once you become a professional, it takes things just to a different level. You become you're a different tier of something if you're a professional at something. Just like, you know, if you're someone who likes sneakers or if you're a sneakerhead, someone who likes a particular thing, or you consider yourself to be an embodiment of like a classification of a collector or curator or a creative director, there's a different conversation that needs to be had there.
Yeah, totally.
But yeah.
And if you're, for example, somebody's into sneakers, or you're a sneakerhead, or you're a sneaker critic, they're completely different things. If you talk about sneakers, but you're a critic, then you don't necessarily have to talk about only the sneakers you like. In fact, you may like them for one reason, but dislike them for another. And I think a lot of people, like you say, who, you know, are looking at it from the outside, they only really think that you're talking about stuff that you're into and that you would wear or buy yourself. And sometimes it's the complete opposite. It's just interesting because you would never wear it and you would never buy it.
Correct.
But I think that's one reason why I like watching you, because you're completely open to that. There's a curiosity that says, actually, would I buy this? Would I wear this? Does it really matter? And I'm like, that's somebody who's interested in clothes. Yeah. It's not just wearing clothes. It's really kind of interested in what clothes can mean and what they can do. So yeah, I'm.
Thank you, man.
Did I say I was a fan?
Thank you, man. That warms my heart. You have no idea. That warms my heart. Let's kind of jump right in, man. We already kind of jumped right in already, right? We're already chit-chatting away. Yeah. I kind of want people to, who are listening to this, and this is, like I said, this is a big moment for me. I'm excited, I'm nervous, all those things, but I want people to kind of get just a baseline understanding from your perspective. Who is Jason Jules? And Jules, that's how you say your last name, right?
Yeah.
Just like, if someone were to bump into you on the street and they're like, wait, who's Jason? What do you do? Why are you on this podcast right now? Like, who are you? That's kind of the question I want to kick things off with.
Yeah, I should have an answer to that, shouldn't I? I have no idea. I actually have no clue. I kind of decide that every morning, and then by the afternoon, I've changed my mind. So I actually have no idea. I think when I was a kid, I used to say I work with people I like, and I work on things I like. And that's, in my head, it makes sense. But when you're sharing with somebody, it actually makes no sense. Somebody with a real job, it's like, what the hell are you talking about? But I guess looking back, what I've done is I have followed that through. So I was into fashion from a very early age, or into clothes, and I never really wanted to get a proper job. I didn't think I was particularly employable. So I started doing kind of marketing and press and stuff for friends. And that became a career, set up a company, which went really well. We ended up working with, like I said, Jamiroquai, Soul to Soul, Desiree, Levi's, Wrangler, you know, all sorts of people and brands and stuff. And I think one of our approaches were that we were a black agency, so we had that kind of quality about us. And the other approach was the fact that we kind of looked at things from a holistic point of view. So it wasn't as if we were just trying to get column inches. We were looking at a way of making the brand or the band that we're working with interesting and relevant to people. And in a way, sometimes kind of challenging people's perceptions of it's almost like having an editorial approach to marketing rather than just like selling the product. So I think that's one of our strengths. And I've always kind of found that approach really interesting. So I guess I look at what I do, which is often, you know, involving clothes or music, but essentially working with people I like, from an editorial point of view. So at one point I used to say, you know, my job is to help make people famous. And it kind of, you know, sometimes it is. But, you know, that's maybe a kind of a trite way of describing it.
And I love that as the foundation for the conversation that we're going to have, because I think there are so many questions that popped into my head that I want to kind of almost systematically approach. I'm a bit of a nerd, Jason. So like sometimes, like when I think about these kind of things, like like what someone does, what they do, it gets a bit funny and quirky, but just bear with me here, okay? Let's take it back, because you know, before we hit the record button, you were kind of giving me a bit of your background in the sense of where you're from. And right now you're in Paraguay.
Paraguay,
which is a place that, damn, I would love to go to Paraguay. Like that seems like a very, very interesting place to me. I'm someone who loves traveling, so like every time I hear of a country that, I mean, I know about Paraguay, but I just don't know much about it. But let me get on point. Let me get on track again. Just from a standpoint of your background, right? Talk to us a little bit about, you know, where you're from and how was it like for you growing up as a kid? Because I always find childhood to teenage to adulthood, like it's a very formative kind of thing. And I'm curious to hear for you what your story is.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a Londoner. You know, if you ask me where I'm from, I would, yeah, people assume I'm British or whatever, but actually my understanding of myself, my identity is that I'm a Londoner. I was born in East London. I pretty much grew up in East London. So, which is kind of important because there's a sense of, it's almost like a cockiness or an arrogance that East Londoners have that I'm sure I do have. And I wouldn't shake it if I could. My parents are from the West Indies, or as people would say, the Caribbean. They're from St. Lucia. They both came to the UK with the understanding they would be working in the rag trade. They'd be making clothes. My dad was a trained tailor. My mum was a trained dressmaker. Mm. My dad never got a job as a tailor. He was considered unemployable again. Because there was kind of like a closed shop. It was very hard for a skilled worker from the West Indies of any profession, really, to get the job that they were trained for when they came to the UK. So my dad, who was a very good tailor, found the job eventually working in a foundry in Ford's, the you know, same as Detroit, basically, the car makers. So he worked in the foundry, which is pretty much the hardest physical, most grueling kind of side of the production line you can imagine. And he worked shifts. So he, you know, sometimes he'd work during the day, sometimes he'd work during the night and sleep during the day. That was kind of important because that meant that I saw a lot of my dad when I was, you know, really young, because my mom would go to work, but my dad would be at home in the day and I'd be looked after by him. And, you know, we'd watch TV, we'd listen to the radio, lots of music. And so I picked up an interest in music and a kind of sense of what made him enthusiastic, which kind of connected me to him a lot. So that was like really important in my kind of formative years. But I think, first of all, their interest in clothing got me into clothing, or got me a sense that I was already involved in clothing. And then when I was about four, I somehow saw this afternoon series of Fred Astaire movies. And I just remember watching them, you know, like maybe four or five, but I just remember this repetitive ritual of sitting in front of the TV, watching these black and white dance things with this guy called Fred Astaire, who I thought was called Alistair. Obviously, you know, four, when I couldn't read. So I was like, I want to see the Alistair film. And I want to see Alistair. And but I really got into clothes, I think, through him, to be honest, through his style, through his, the way he danced or whatever, just in that humor and the cockiness again. So by four, I was super into clothes. You know, by five, my parents were saying to me, we can't take you shopping. You have to go shopping on your own. You have to buy your own stuff because you're basically a pain in the neck. And what you want is always too expensive. So you have to go and experience this stuff yourself. So they'd take me shopping, but you know, I'd have to go through the pain of understanding why I couldn't afford it or whatever. But then I, like yourself, I guess I'm a bit of a nerd or a geek or something. I don't think I was that academic at school or that sporty. I was kind of like the odd kid who was everybody's friend, if you know what
yes,
I mean.
Yes, I know exactly what you mean.
So, but I was, you know, I understood myself to be super odd. And at a certain point, I kind of just had to accept that I would be dressing differently, listening to different music, et cetera, understanding the music that my mates were into, but also having this other interest, which kind of almost like was like a trend-setting interest. So at a very early age, I kind of realized that what I was into, I'd very often get criticized for or ridiculed for, but then maybe a year later or 2 years later, the same people who were ridiculing me would be asking me about it. So I always think that's kind of, again, one of the things that I've turned into a career, if you know what I mean. Like, you kind of discover trends, you see patterns, and you celebrate them or you interrogate them or whatever. I studied English and philosophy at university, and then I started basically going to clubs because, my first job was doing PR in fashion, like my first and only job. I spent a year working for essentially the best fashion PR in the country, Lynn Frank's PR. And my goal was to become a stylist. But once I started doing PR, I really got into that idea of, like I said, making people famous, kind of creating these kind of scenes and stuff. And there was like a really strong editorial element to it. So, but I wasn't fashion. I lasted there a year. It seemed like I lasted a lot longer because I still know a lot of the people that I met in that solid 12 months. There's still a lot of contacts. The guys who work there are still like really good friends. But I realized that I wasn't fashion. I couldn't wear black every day. The air kissing for a working class black kid was just a bit too weird. I guess I was too rough at the edges or whatever it is, but it wasn't for me. So I left and started organizing clubs because I was really into jazz music and had a lot of friends who were basically DJs or musicians. And I kind of just kept going from there. So that was what I realized after I left Lind's is that I really can't work with things or in environments that I'm not committed to. So I was lucky enough to start doing clubs and they became successful, so I just kept on doing that.
Amazing, man. Amazing. That is a pretty comprehensive look back at your life. It seems like from being an East Londoner, that identity, to having the opportunity to spend time with your dad because he was working at night and he was home during the day and he was sleeping, but he was still around and his influence on your life played a pivotal role in your journey. Then to getting hooked on Fred Astaire. And watching his performances and his form of media kind of just build such curiosity in you for fashion, which led to the next step of you kind of growing up, getting older, realizing that you want to be a part of some element within this kind of world. Because even at a young age, you wanted to be in fashion, you wanted to buy things. But obviously, like, that's the thing when you're young, you see the cool things that you see on TV or magazines or famous people or whatever it may be, and you're like, I want to, like, that's cool, I want to dress like that. And then you have a very kind of deafening realization that you can't dress like that, my friend, at your age. It's gonna take either some incredible creativity from the ability to actually create garments yourself, or you're gonna have to have an affluent lifestyle to where you can actually afford the pieces that you're seeing, right? And then obviously,
Which I
yeah,
had.
no, exactly. And I mean, the majority of us don't, right? I mean, there's a reason why the 1% is the 1%, the 10% is the 10%. Everyone else falls in the 90%. That's everybody else. So, it's very common, right? And then obviously as you got older, there's more there. But I'm curious about your relationship with you and your dad a little bit more. Because it seems like for you, it was something that stuck out to you, and it's something that played a relatively large role. Obviously, like, you love your mom probably too, loved your mom probably too, and like those things are important. But it seems like for whatever reason, your dad and both your parents actually had a pretty, not profound, but pretty large fashion impact on your life. Can you talk more to just what it was like for you and your dad, when you guys were hanging out in those days when he was, available at home with you? Did you have siblings too, by the way? I was curious about that as well.
I have a younger brother and an older sister.
Nice.
So my sister's like a couple of years older. My brother's like 10 years
Yeah.
younger. And Yeah, my dad and myself, we had a, let's call it a pithy relationship, because it wasn't always smooth. Because I didn't really fit the mold of, the kind of super, the masculine, sporty, athletic kid. I could be athletic, I could be sporty, I could run as fast as anyone, probably faster, but I didn't, in my head, I didn't want to compete. There was this other thing going on. So I kind of refused to play that game, if you know what I mean. I wanted to be something else. I mean, I think one of the things that was really important was the fact that I was a, I know it sounds weird, but I was a dualed. And being in this kind of group of different families, somehow the dualses had this supposed had this kind of, like you say, interesting clothing, kind of a supposed to have a certain flair, a certain confidence. And I think I kind of picked up on that. Just not for myself, but just seeing the way my dad was treated among his kind of peers, etc. They would talk to him about clothes and go to him for, tailoring advice or whatever. But then also, I think one of the other major big things was one of his nieces came to stay with us for a while, and she was called Cynthia Jules, and she was into David Bowie. So I had this kind of, she had two other sisters who were older than her, and but just as cool as her. They're like, when I was about 8, they were like 16, or she was like 16. And I remember going to her house once, her parents' house, and it was the first time I saw a poster of David Bowie in her room. And she had afro hair, but she also had a kind of like a red streak through her afro hair. And I hadn't seen her for a while. She would look like David, but she's like from outer space. And it was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. And from that point on, literally, I think I was 8. I was really into Bowie. So there was Fred Astaire on one side, and then there was Bowie on the other. And the thing about Bowie is that he was into image and into kind of like constructed identities, and mixing, kind of plastic life with real life. And that, even at 8, that idea really got to me, that you could create an image and you could be that image for a period and then be something else. So, all that stuff didn't really kind of work with my dad, because he thought we should be into, I was listening to Bowie and Roxy Music and all sorts of weird experimental music by the time I was 10, and he thought I should be like my mates listening to reggae and soul. I was, because my sister was buying that stuff, but I was also bringing this other weird stuff into their house, and he was worried that I was trying to be weird for the sake of being weird. That was his concern, and I would kind of ostracize myself from, the normalcy that all the other kids were experiencing. And I kind of did, but I was kind of happy doing that as well, if you know what I mean. So we had like I said, a kind of pithy relationship, where he really wanted me to kind of follow a path of normalcy, and nothing kind of scared me or depressed me more than that path. So, it was like this kind of really weird relationship. But then he had an incredible amount of style. He was the king of the one-liner. He had an unbelievable collection of music. He was a great dad, but we had this relationship.
Yeah, I love that. And I think, it's I'm glad I poked that out of you a little bit, because that to me is,
Because you
yeah,
knew.
I don't know,
You could see
somewhere
it.
deep down I knew there was something about it, 'cause the moment you said that you spent so much time with him and that you had this kind of relationship, I knew that there was something there. And obviously, like, the interactions you have with your father and your mother and your siblings, they're so developmental in terms of like who you become. And it probably, and maybe this is forward of me to say this, but like that kind of inclination for you to be different, to kind of seek your own validation in music and culture, that's just a tangent separate from what maybe your siblings or your mates, as you say, as East Londoners say. I love that, by the way. As an American boy, that's so good. But as you know, you're kind of separating yourself from your mates and like kind of carving your own path as a, you know, as a Black person too, as someone who is, you know, in a culture scape that is, you're not the dominant culture in a sense, right? Like your identity isn't the dominant culture. It's very fascinating to me. Very, very fascinating. And it's cool to hear you kind of elaborate that on that as well. I've never heard that. I've listened to a couple of your other interviews. I never heard that piece. So that's really cool.
No one's ever asked me.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. Well, you come on the Drew Joyner podcast. We'll ask you the real hard hitting questions. Well, I want to kind of, so this is fantastic. Okay. So I want to ask one more question about your background. Then I want to start talking about Black Ivy, because obviously like for me, Black Ivy is really important. But we'll get into that. Just one final question about kind of upbringing, background. You know, when you look back on your time in East London, growing up, going to school, getting an education, entering into the workforce, maybe there's like one or two moments. Like, what are some of the like one or two moments that were the most formative moments that led to the Jason Jules we see today? I understand that the Jules last name has this kind of this weight to it that, you know, you tried to honor and that you felt as a kid. But what else, you know, what else were things that stood out to you or stand out to you in your life that were like, if I would have went left, it could have ended like this, or if I would have went right, or I just, those kind of things, right?
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely some moments. I mean, you know, like things that, like you say, could be minor, except in a sense, I kind of retain them, so they mustn't have been that minor. Mm. For example, I remember going to, there was a club called the WAG Club, or rather a venue. Sorry. There was a venue called the WAG Club in Soho, London. And in all the kind of style publications, it was talked about as this really cool place to go. And I wanted to go to this club. And I'd been to a couple of other kind of, I don't know what you'd call them, like underground clubs. And on this occasion, I went with some of my school friends. So it was a Friday night and I went to this club. You know, we got on the last train from East London to Central London. And so we're like 17 years old. And we get there and the way the policy is, it's kind of like, you know, Nels or Studio 54, et cetera, where the doorman selects you and says you can or cannot come in, but there's always a queue. So we're standing in this queue, like four of us, one girl, three guys. We get to the top of the queue and there's this doorman and he says, you can't come in. We've waited 20 minutes. He knocks us back. So before you know it, we're back heading towards East London, except this time we're going on the night bus because the trains have gone. And my three friends were all in a really good mood. They were like, it's just another night. But to me, I was devastated. And I thought, I don't know what's going to take, but I need to be in that club. And in a sense, my arrogance said, I'm blaming these three for me not getting in. So I hatched a, you know, I'm 17, I'm sorry. So I hatched a plan to go to this club, but I knew that I would never get in there on my own volition. So I've told the owner this since. What I decided to do was I phoned them up and said, I want to write an article about your club. And I don't know who I'm writing it for, but I want to write this article. And then I'm going to kind of submit it to some people. So the guy whose club it was, who was like the main partner, was a guy called Chris Sullivan. He had a band called Blurando a la Turk. And he was, you know, he wrote for publications. He had this band. He was like, you know, and he had this club. So he was it. So I phone him up at the club and I say, you know, my name's Jason. I want to do this article. He says, great. Come down on the Thursday around, you know, before the club opens. We can have the interview. I'll show you around and see what you reckon. So he did that. And I get to the door of this club and the guy who knocked us back a couple of weeks before was the guy on the door. So he basically let me in. I said, I'm here to see Chris. He says, all right, so you can come in. And since from that point on, when Chris introduced me to the doorman and the staff, who, you know, the cloakroom and the bar staff and the DJs, that club was kind of completely open for me. But so the pivotal moment was when I, at the night bus, when I figured, actually, I have to get into that club. And from that point on, I met like thousands of people, literally. Yeah.
Oh, man.
So, you know, getting knocked back was probably the best thing that ever happened.
Man, oh man, I love this story. I love this story. It speaks a lot to your character, your arrogance. Now you're not going to tell me I'm not going to do something. I'm going to make this happen for me if it's the last thing I do. And I think, like, why do you think? And this is a side note, but why do you think you told yourself I have to get into this club? Like, what was the trigger point for you? It was just the fact that they wouldn't let you in, or like, what was the like? What do you think?
I actually don't know. I just somehow I knew that was an interesting place. I'd read so much about it. I'd listened to, you know, Chris Sullivan's band, et cetera, all this stuff. The clothes that they were wearing, I was already wearing. It was, you know, there was this thing going on in my head that made me think, actually, I really belong in that space.
There was
space.
This pull towards it.
Yeah. And I just had to do it. Yeah,
for sure. I think, on this podcast, Jason, I love, like, if creators are listening, I love when you tell me stories like this, because to me, like, this is an incredibly great example of how you used a very clever and witty way to get an opportunity, right? And I think for a lot of people, you know, if they don't get into the club, a lot of people will say, well, it's just not the night. It's just not my time. I don't want to do this. This isn't the club for me. But for you, it like the ability to say, how do I get into this club? And one of the ways that you went about doing that is you thought, okay, let me write an article. Let me say I'm going to write an article or have something that I can bring value to them for, so that then if I bring them value in some way, you're golden. You're golden. You're absolutely golden. Just like, you know, I've talked to other podcasters about this on podcast and off podcast. Podcasting is one of the best things in the world because even if you don't, like, no one knows how many people listen to this podcast. We have a decent amount of viewership, which is, I'm happy to say. But, like, at the same time, if you're new to the podcast game and you want to talk to anyone, literally anyone in the industry, it could be a standard deviation away from someone like a celebrity, Tyler the Creator, someone crazy, right? It could be a standard deviation away from someone like that. You can talk to them because Tyler has a manager, he has a marketing director, he has people around him, and you can get so much good information if you know how to navigate approaching opportunities. And I think even like as a 17-year-old, you probably didn't necessarily think, oh yeah, this is going to be the thing that puts all of this into effect, but maybe you kind of did, but you didn't know, like, maybe to the level that it ended up being. I find that, like, that really, really cool. That's really, really powerful to me. Yeah.
A nice one. I mean, I think you're right. The actual, in hindsight, what I realized I was doing was offering some kind
value.
Of value. And I didn't, maybe I did realize that. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I knew deep down that my friends were not even remotely upset. They were having a great time. And I was just, why are we
for
here?
Sure. I love that, man. I love that. I love that. I love it. Let's talk about the book, because, or no, not just the book, but let's talk about the genre, right? For people who don't understand, one of the,
actually, could I interject there?
Cause yeah, for sure. Talk to me.
One reason that I haven't, cause I just think about the conversation about my dad. One reason that I haven't ever really discussed it is because I haven't really thought about it in that way until kind of last year properly, when I did this exhibition called The Missing Fred in London. And it was about, you know, it was about Black British fashion, but the roots of it was about the I guess the immigration that took place in the early 60s, of which my parents were part. And so a lot of it was kind of biographical, in the sense that, you know, it was from my parents' arrival and their generation, looking at my generation and the generations after, and how, you know, the Black experience and relationship between us and British fashion kind of has this really interesting kind of exchange and narrative. And so the whole exhibition was about that. But when I was writing the book, you know, Missing Fred, I had to really interrogate my own kind of relationship and also look at the experience of my parents from their point of view. So, you know, my dad's passed away, but I did talk to my mum a lot about how hard or easy it was when she first got to the UK. And, you know, there was stuff that I never crossed my mind, like literally. The fact that when she was, you know, in the West Indies, she wasn't West Indian. She was St. Lucian. And the person on the other island was from Barbados and the other island was from Dominica. But then when you get to the UK, you're just West Indian. And even beyond that, you're just black. So she'd never actually been black before until she got to the UK. And being black was considered derogatory by the people addressing you as black, because your West Indian, quote unquote, West Indian friends from Dominica or Barbados, they saw you as, so I'd always, as a kid, I'd always wonder, well, why are they saying, where is she from? You know, she's black. Why does it matter if she's from Barbados or from St. Kitts or some, but now, well, at least last year, I kind of interrogating, I realized that was new to them. It really did matter where you're from. So yeah, for the first time, literally last year, I really did investigate a lot of that stuff. And I see their experience completely different as a result of doing the exhibition.
That's so fascinating.
So hence the conversation.
Yeah, I find that part of culture and history to me is like one of the most interesting things to me, because it's the same thing in the US, but it as someone who's a child of, honestly, like if I look at my grandma and her grandmother's slaves, their yeah. ethnicity, their heritage has been erased in a way, right? And so for me, like, I know at some point in my life, I'm going to be looking for my family, my direction of where I came from. And it sounds like, and this happens a lot of times with immigrants, a lot of times, is that you get grouped. And if you are someone from the West Indies or from the Caribbean, you're black. I mean, people may or may not understand the fact that you're from Barbados or you're from the Dominican Republic or you're from different islands. Like, no, I mean, they may understand it, but most people are not going to really investigate. But if you take the inverse of that, and this is no shade to any group of people, but I have a lot of friends, obviously. We all have friends and people who we know who are Irish or Italian or French, and the difference in the, not only the attention that those places get from their movement to the places like the US. Like if you go to New York, you understand that, you know, there's Little Italy, and then there's like French Polynesia, and then there's like all of these very small, like, niche communities that get their own respective kind of attention and culture in places in the US, where obviously, like, now in 2023, people are aware of these things now, but in the past it wasn't the same way, right? Like, you were just black. And I find that very interesting for you to tell that story about how you were talking with your mom about that. And yeah, it's just very, very fascinating. And that's why also for Black Ivy, like, it's a huge part of understanding culture, in the sense that, like, they're like, culture is so dynamic, right? There's always, like, it seems like a million things happening at one time. While you have, like, what popular culture is in London is totally different from subcategorical yeah. culture happening in East London with those who immigrated from the West Indies, right? But, like, obviously the popular culture still dictates a lot of what everyone feels, but no one really talks about those, like, subgroups, right? And so, I don't know, that to me is, like, I don't know, I just wanted to say it. I don't have any, like, profound thoughts about it. I was just talking about it.
You're right. People don't really talk about those subgroups, but also, when we do, we often talk about them in relation to the dominant group. So, a lot of the time, it's the question is, how does this subgroup impact or influence the dominant group? As if their validity can only exist if they have a relevance or an impact on the mainstream. Actually, like you say, they can just exist quite happily on their own without any impact at all to the rest of the world and still be valid. And that's, I think, you know, something that we should try and kind of recognize, that actually it doesn't need to be relevant or have an impact to exist and be valid. It just can be, and that's enough sometimes.
Totally. All right, well, let me ask you the hot question. Starting off with just like very simply, we're going to be talking about Black Ivy. What is Black Ivy? How would you describe it? And if, for those who maybe have never heard the term or don't understand what it is at all, and at any level, they're hearing it for the first time, what is Black Ivy?
So maybe we should look at kind of two separate elements. There's Ivy, let's start with that. And Ivy is the term for a group of colleges which have, I don't know, elite attendances, say. So there's Harvard, there's Yale, etc.
The Ivy Leagues.
The Ivy League colleges. And these are the prestigious colleges in the US that are seen as the places where presidents go and, you know, leaders of industry go. So they're super hard to get into. They're super moneyed. And like I said, they're super elite. But they're what you consider the establishment. And so they're conservative. They're the kind of definition of what it means to be an American, in a sense, and to be aspire to be American. But then on the other hand, you have Black, which at the time in the 60s was kind of defined or mobilized by the civil rights movement. And that movement was looking to get equal rights, to get equal possibilities of education, employment, basically just to be recognized as Americans in the same way that white Americans were. Now, kind of now, that doesn't seem like too much to ask. But at the time, it was like an abhorrence, because there was the assumption that Black people were less than, and really, you know, considered second-class citizens more, you know, in most of the US, let's say, as a generalization. So the civil rights movement, a lot of the members of the civil rights movement kind of recognized that equality, you don't just kind of fight for equality. You sometimes have to assume the position of equality. You have to be it before, and present it before you can claim it. And the clothing that was worn by the guys in the Ivy League colleges was super popular at the time in the US, but the connotation still remained. It was still about, you know, being sophisticated, being elite, being accomplished, successful, et cetera, and being American. So aware that those values were important, and it was important to be seen to embrace those values, a lot of members of the civil rights movement started wearing those clothes with that purpose in mind. So when I wrote the book Black Ivy, it was really talking about the way in which clothing and Ivy League clothing in and of itself was adopted by civil rights activists and you know, people who are kind of agents of change. So they would be poets or jazz musicians or actors, these people who are basically agents of change, and how they adopted that clothing and, in a sense, co-opted that clothing to their own ends. So essentially, that's what Black Ivy is.
Right. And they made it their own, right? And as I've kind of gone through the book, I would say I'm about 40% of the way there. I haven't completed it yet. Sometimes it's three times visual, one times words, right? And so I just look at the outfits and I'm going, wow, 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 wow.
Yeah.
And the thing is that, like, I'm going wow because a lot of times I would have no idea about these figures. Obviously, like, I have parents who grew up who were young, but grew up 60s and 70s, 80s. And obviously, even for them, they learned about civil rights and they just had a different approach to understanding culture. They knew the figures in America or in the U.S. at least that were making headlines and films, Sidney Poitier, the Miles Davises of the world, these kind of figures who were important culturally, but maybe they weren't dialed in as much to the outfits that they decorated themselves with. And so for me, now as someone who cares a lot about this stuff, to be able to visually understand and put context on the outfits, just how you explain with just understanding Ivy and like understanding Take Ivy and then that whole kind of stylistic dialect that's been pulled out that a lot of people are talking about again now. It's really fascinating just to look at outfits from this era, especially on black men and entertainers and people who are, like you said, agents of change. I like that term a lot, agents of change. Do you practice that? Did you practice that one?
No, I just...
It just came out. That's good. I like that. I'm going to use that. Agents of change. That's really cool.
Yeah, me too. We can share.
Perfect. Now.
But also, yeah. What I realized in a kind of, I know, semi-biographical way, I guess, is that there is this idea that if a black person is wearing that clothing and into that clothing, then it makes a lot these days, or at least in the recent past, there's this assumption that they're not as committed to, you know, their blackness as other people who wouldn't be wearing those clothes. The idea is that they're aspiring to the Ivy League lifestyle as opposed to their own personal journeys. And so I think one of the reasons that I wanted to write the book and kind of saw it as relevant is that it's not really just about the past. It's about understanding, you know, identity now, and the idea that we don't necessarily have to subscribe to what the mainstream tells us is, you know, kind of consensually accepted as a black appearance or a black style.
Totally.
And we have to question where that comes from, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, totally.
But, so it's kind of like that was one of the reasons why I kind of enjoyed writing the book, because I could see that the kind of, how can I put it, the correlation between now and what was happening then.
Totally. Well. And I think, I still think, let's get really deep here, because I think this is at the core of why I think this is such an important book as well, because, you know, I'll give you an example, right? When I was growing up, personal story, I grew up in Colorado. Colorado is not a very black state. There's not a lot of black people in Colorado. But within Colorado, of course, there's going to be blacks. There's going to be African Americans that congregate, and you have your black community, right? When I was in school, I went to school with, you know, what I would say is a accurate breakdown of what the percentage of race would be in the U.S. So, like, you have majority of the kids in my school are white kids. Then you have another portion who are Hispanic, Latina, Latino, whatever it may be. Another portion that are black. Another portion that are Native American, Pacific Island, whatever it may be, right? I remember, you know, and just as a lot of people understand culture and understand identity, there was a subset of kids in my school who looked quote unquote black, if that makes sense, right? Whatever that idea is in for your head, right? They maybe at the time during the mid-2000s or 20-teens is when I was in high school, they dressed in a particular way. They wore particular shoes. They had a particular vernacular speech that they spoke with. And a lot of people associated that with blackness for the schools that I went to. And for me, I was always kind of how you said earlier on, someone who's just a deviation away, right? Just a little bit different from what you would traditionally associate with a particular image of a group of people. And I remember a lot, because I played sports, I remember a lot of times from my teammates to other black kids in the school, they would always say like one particular thing to me, like, Drew, like, we like you, whatever it is, we're friends. Like, I was friends with a lot of people, but they would always say, you just don't sound black. You just don't act black. That to me was something that I got a lot as a young person growing up. And it's something that stuck with me because it always made me think about what does it mean to be black. And what does it mean when you're saying, whether you're another black person or African-American person, that you don't see me as the same as you? It's just very, very fascinating, because I think it goes back to this idea of what media and what kind of like social mental thoughts, I don't know how to say it, how we think about what it means to be black. And I think as we've progressed, as I've gotten older, I think that more, less and less people say that. They just view my blackness as a form of who I am. It's not a matter of you're not black, you're black, whatever it is. But as a young person, there's still this, like, I felt this very strong push from my peers that, you know, you're not black. You're not, you don't act like one of us. And, you know, there would be moments where, of course, there would be moments, oh, like, yeah, he is black. He does do these kind of things. And then there'd be moments he's not, because I'm into, you know, Japanese anime and there's certain TV shows and certain music and things like that. So, but now, I mean, obviously in 2024, everything's cool. Everything's fine. But when I was a kid, I just felt that. I don't know if you had something similar for yourself, or if that's just, you just evaluated that in culture through Black Ivy, or if that's something personal for you too.
Oh, I definitely had that. And, you know, have that. I think I was lucky because, like I said, in school, it was just a bunch of kids and of, you know, we're Londoners first and foremost. So there was pretty much every denomination, not denomination, it was a Catholic school, but every race was there. And we all pretty much just were these kids in this school. You know, the fact is we were, the school was our culture. There was some Bonaventure's boys, that was it. And like I said, I did bring weird music, but it didn't define me. And I did like, you know, the music that the other kids brought into school, etc. So it was this, you know, and I was part of a reggae sound system, believe it or not, you know, with my other mates. So it's, but I think you're right. There's this idea that there's a prescribed notion of what blackness is. And we all seem to be meant to kind of aspire to that by degrees. And we have to really question who has prescribed that definition of blackness and what the downside of it is. Because, you know, if oftentimes, you know, a kid who goes to college and comes out with a college degree and wants to be a lawyer is defined as not black enough because you're meant to be doing something else. But that's to the detriment of all of us, the fact that we don't encourage people to have educations and to, you know, have careers and all the rest of it. So it's a real, you know, we have to really question that definition, and also not dispose of it, but just kind of play with it and you know, kind of discuss it, because who defines us? That, do you know what I mean? Like, who has given us this idea of what blackness, black masculinity, black femininity, what where these things come from? And if we're talking about a dominant culture, then maybe it's definitions from the dominant culture that we're often trying to kind of exist within, and they're not serving us. They're not serving us in a positive way or in a beneficial way. If actually, often they're harming us. So, I think you're completely right that actually, as kids, we're often more honest and more, our experiences are more limited. So we say what we see. We think, actually, you don't speak like a black person. If I didn't know you, you wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't equate you. Where did you get that accent from? I got that a ton of times, you know, and I'd even have explanations for it. I got it so often. So, but it's just, who defines blackness? That's really the real question.
I think ideally it would be,
that's not my definition of blackness.
Ideally, it would be the individual, right? That's how it is for everyone else, right? Every person gets to define what it means to be Jason Jules, Drew Joyner, blah, 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 whoever you are, whoever's listening to this, you get to define it. And if you're black listening to this, you get to define it as well. I think that's important for people to hear, because there's a force out there that I think still plays a role in a lot of people's mind that tries to tell you have to be this, that, and the third. And it's not true. So I don't mean to cut you off there. I'm sorry.
No, you're completely right. That's it. And also, you know, and I suppose that's for me why creativity and stuff like film and music have always been really important, because, like I said, you know, from the age of eight, I was into David Bowie, and I could understand that you can construct an image and then change the image. You could be this person, you could explore this idea and then become something else. It's not, like you said at the very beginning, culture is this thing, it keeps on changing, keeps on moving. Culture, by definition, is not fixed. And so blackness, by definition, is not fixed. Race is not fixed. But oftentimes we're told that it is, and we're kind of hemmed in by it. So I'm really excited by the idea of, you know, musicians and creatives who kind of challenge those preconceptions and really kind of open our eyes to what is possible. And also, like, as a collective, if we as groups of people just buy into this stuff, if we buy into Andre 3000 or Tyler the Creator or George Clinton or John Coltrane or Miles Davis, if we buy into their creativity and their reference points are not, you know, like I said, the prescribed points of what blackness is supposed to be, but they are black and a million black people like it, then there's something else going on. You know, totally. Like, to me, that's really exciting. Yeah,
I totally, totally agree. I think that's this is one of the more like mentally satiating topics that I feel like we could go on and on and on about, because it is like it's very interesting. And you mentioned some of the agents of change in the book here, John Coltrane, Miles Davis. Who in your opinion, for those who maybe want to pick up the book, or no, not even that, who in your opinion are some of the more pivotal agents of change that you decided to highlight, you and your partner decided to highlight in Black Ivy?
Miles Davis, definitely, like without any question, because he, number one, on the most kind of obvious level, he had an amazing style throughout his life and career. He saw the kind of the connection between all his creative aspects, from painting to clothing to music to performance. All of those things were like a conscious construct, and he was fully aware of what he was doing and unapologetic about it as well. And also because he came from a Black Ivy background, you know, his dad had a pig farm. His dad was super wealthy. You know, his dad was like a physician. And so Miles knew about those clothes. Miles had no fear of that aesthetic or that environment. And so, you know, it wasn't as if, and as he evolved, his style was always true to himself. There's a level of authenticity about him that continued as a through line. And again, his music was kind of fearless in the same respect. So I think for me, one of the most important people was Miles, and that's kind of why Graham and the publishers suggested that he be on the cover. And when we found that image, there was no question. You know, that's the image that kind of, to me, sums up the whole attitude of what Black Ivy is, in the sense that there's a level of defiance about the gaze, but also there's a warmth about it. It's not, you know, it's not horrendous. It's kind of super intelligent. It's like, okay, I know what I'm doing. You are included in this conversation. It's about style, but style is the complete, how can I put it, the complete essence of who we are. It's not just about, you know, the surface. There's a style from within. And I think that's what hopefully that cover conveys. And that's why, to me, Miles was incredibly important. But then there are people like Eric Dolphy, who is like incredibly cerebral and smart and, you know, redefined the way people listen to music. And again, you know, once you, it's almost like the intro is the clothing for a lot of us. And then once you get past that, you realize that actually there's so much more going on. You know, both he and John Coltrane, they, at one point they were like offending everybody on stage because they were literally having almost like rehearsal or practice sessions in front of paying audiences and saying that the audiences were kind of privileged to be seeing them do this. I mean, that's a complete flip of the idea of kind of performing to the audience and keeping them super happy and playing, you know, stuff that they're familiar with. They were just committed to their craft and their art. And in that process, they were rebelling without any intention of rebelling. They were just not allowing people's restrictive points of view to stop them from being creative. And to me, that's huge. That's why a lot of the jazz musicians feature in the book, because there was a generation who basically subscribed to that idea.
Yeah, that's such an important idea. I feel like that is encapsulated in the book, and you feel that when you read the passages, when you look at the style, and then like when you give the context of particular critics that are also criticizing these artists. I can't remember which one, but I was reading about it the other day, and how essentially one of the critics, he was saying how like these two artists in particular, jazz musicians, were I think it was Coltrane and someone else, I can't remember, but they were just
I think it might have been Eric.
Yes, it might have been.
And they were anti-jazz.
Exactly, anti-jazz. Exactly. I mean, imagine that level of criticism coming from, it's just, I don't know. It really speaks to, like you said, the revolt in style. And I think I just got it. I was going to ask you about that title, because like, what is the revolt? But it seems like it is this kind of staying true to one's objective, creative objective, which is to bring something unique to the space. And while like looking at things in hindsight, you're like, well, that's great that these individuals did that at the time in real time, during the moments that these things were going on, it's not as easy to do. That is a true revolt, right? That's what you would say.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Man, that's so, so good. That's so, so good. I wanted to ask you about Black Ivy. Well, obviously, but I wanted to ask you about this idea of social language. I was listening to one of your other interviews, and this idea of clothing as a form of social language is something that I heard from you. And then a couple of weeks ago, I was listening to a Articles of Interest podcast, and they were talking about kind of a very similar thing. And I just made an entire video about it as well, about how clothing is a form of social language. With that idea front of mind, what do you think Black Ivy communicated in the 20th century? I know you kind of touched on this a little bit. And then how would you contrast that to what Black Ivy communicates now in 2024?
I mean, as what it communicates now, I'm not sure. You know, I was going to ask you that same question. I think at the time, it was definitely a challenge to people's ideas of what, you know, a Black person should be kind of aspiring to in terms of clothing. But also, you know, it's like, because there were different perspectives, different points of view, different ways of seeing the same thing. So, you know, there's this, like you said, the music critic who will say this is anti-jazz, but then people like Charlie Mingus and Coltrane and the rest of those guys would say it's a sound of freedom. So essentially, the person who says it's anti-jazz, are they, by definition, anti that type of freedom? Without even being conscious of it, is that the position that they're kind of putting themselves into? So the way I think it was seen at the time is, you know, at one point it was an affront because you can't have these Black people who should be sharecroppers and working in kind of, I don't know, farms and stuff, dressed like they're college graduates. That's the way a lot of the mainstream would kind of respond to it. I think part of that, unfortunate part of that presumption, that idea kind of continues. So if you know if you see a Black person dressed in a three-piece suit with a button-down shirt and a rep tie and a pair of wingtip shoes, often, you know, at a certain point you will ask yourself the question, what are they buying into? Whereas back then, I think they were very aware of what they were buying into and what they were aspiring to. And I think, like I said before, the idea is that there's this limiting belief that we can only buy into certain things, we're allowed to be into certain things. I think one of the problems is that we were taught, or maybe your parents were taught this as well, that the civil rights movement failed because we still have to struggle for our rights globally, not just in the US, but everywhere. And so as a result, there's a kind of a look at that moment in time as if it was a failure, and the people who actually made those sacrifices and were brave enough to do those things, they failed as well, in the sense that they failed us. The reality is that they didn't fail. It's the mainstream that failed in delivering the promises that they made. That movement delivered on every level. And obviously, Martin Luther King was shot, Malcolm X was shot, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The Kennedys, that was a kind of betrayal of the promise. And so even though now we see, oftentimes we're told that it failed, it didn't fail. It was failed. Somebody else failed it. And if we understand it from that point of view, then we change the way we see the way those guys dress, because they dressed with courage. They, you know, wearing a free piece suit, a wrap tie, a button down shirt, and some wingtip shoes was actually a really brave move. It was a defiant move, because you're meant to be this farmer, this sharecropper. So, but now, because we think they failed, we think that's a compromising move. We think we're trying to, you know, aspire to the white kind of belief system. But it's at the time, that was not the case. That was a very brave, defiant, courageous sacrifice that was being made. And there's a power in that, but there's also a power in understanding it from that point of view, from that period of time. And all it takes really is understanding that the civil rights movement didn't fail. Education and getting an education is not a compromise. It's an achievement. You know, wanting to be a lawyer is not a bad thing. Speaking with an accent from wherever is not an indication of your politics. It's just your accent. And that's how, you know, hopefully, that's what I hope people will see Black Ivy as now. A kind of a level of freedom that we allow each other, like you said, to define ourselves, not being defined by some mainstream idea of what we're meant to be.
100%.
If that makes sense.
100%.
Did that make sense?
It makes sense. 100%. I agree with you. I mean, honestly, it was really so well put that, like, I kind of want to clip it and put it on a reel right now, honestly. But no, 100%. I think, and for me, like when I think about it in its modern context, because I know you also mentioned that you want me to kind of answer, like when I hear you explain the importance during the time period, it is that revolt, it is that rebellion. I think for me, as someone who is in their 20s, who grew up in America in a time period where, at least where I went to school in Colorado, I didn't go to school in the South. Colorado is a kind of Western state that has its affiliations, it has its political tones to it, whatever it may be, that those things influence my education system. I always felt like the U.S. was heading in a positive direction, especially as a young Black kid. Regardless of your political association, I always thought when Barack Obama was elected president, I was in middle school. I always thought, like, wow. Like, it's proof that America is doing it. Like, America is no longer the America of the past. And obviously, I didn't understand all of the cultural things happening from... I just didn't understand geopolitics. I didn't understand any of that stuff, right? I didn't understand fashion. I was just a kid, and I thought these things. And now that I've grown up a little bit, and I'm into fashion, and I care about all the things that make a responsible adult, it, for me, in the modern context, it still goes back to... allowing people to have different avenues to express themselves, right? And I think that still today, in America and across the world, Blacks are seen as like the highest aspiration a Black person can be. And this is not my belief, but this is what I believe other people believe, is that, you know, you can be an athlete, you can be an entertainer. That is the quintessential Black individual who made it, who's successful, right? Either somehow you're doing something in entertainment or doing something as athletically. And that's how you see a lot of Black people are portrayed, the most successful, right? And for me, like when I look at this book and I read about the stories and I read about these individuals who were revolting against, and fighting for their civil rights, like to me, it's one of the most powerful expressions of blackness that it's just so undeniable that if someone were to try to criticize these individuals for dressing in this way from a hindsight perspective, like it's almost, to me, it feels anti-black in a way, right? It feels anti-yourself. Now, you don't have to agree with everything that these people said or believe, but for the most part, it was net positive, right? And so, like, but people don't know about this kind of stuff. People just aren't aware of Miles Davis's style or John Coltrane's style. They just aren't aware. And so what still is the most dominant visual interpreted aspect of culture as an African-American is still the rapper, movie star, LA, Miami, those kind of things. And that still is what people not strive to be, but they see. And I mean, yeah, they strive to be in some ways, right? So for me, in a modern context, it gives more, it like securely plants your foot in this idea that it's possible to be more than just this two-path athlete, entertainer route. You can express yourself in a totally different way. They did it, and they did it so beautifully, and you can't deny that. You can't take it away from them. And I think that that's what it means to me. I don't know if I explained that well at all. See, I feel in the same way as you.
Yeah, that's amazing. That is amazing.
But that's what I think of it.
Absolutely
now.
Absolutely amazing. And what gets me is that like you say, there's this kind of idea that's sold to us, or repeatedly sold to us, that the definition of blackness, there are these two role models that we have to aspire to. But the reality is that there's such a diverse world, even just behind those two definitions, but they're never given any kind of avenue for expression or a kind of approval. We're just seeing those two forefront ideas. And even the people who are at those two forefront ideas are countering those ideas. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
So you have basketball players who are building schools, or you have basketball players who are telling you about, it's not about sport, it's about mindset, and it's about self-belief. And those principles, you can apply to literally anything. But we are told that they're just basketball players. No, they're philosophers. They're like high achievers on any level. If they took that mindset and applied it to whatever they wanted to, they would, by definition, succeed. But we're only meant to understand, success in terms of sport and entertainment.
Yeah, totally.
And reduce it to
totally,
that.
Totally, totally. And, I have, with the world we live into, I know someone's probably going to be listening and be like, what are these two dudes talking about? Obviously, there's a level of nuance, and there's a caveat to everything that we say too, right?
Absolutely.
Of course, I'm not saying it's intrinsically bad to want to strive to be an athlete or an entertainer. If that is in your core essence and that's what you're striving for and you intend to make your mark on the world in that way, that's beautiful. Do that. I think it's amazing. I think it's important to have that level of self-awareness, because there's nothing intrinsically wrong about it, right? There still can be something that can grow beautiful from that bud, that seed of hope for whoever yeah. that is. And just like in the book, I mean, we're not just talking about civil rights individuals who were just quote unquote political figures. We're talking about musicians. We're talking about entertainers. We're talking about comedians. We're talking about all these kind of things. We're talking about culture.
Yeah.
And it's hard.
Basketball players.
The whole lot. Yeah. The whole lot. It's hard to like, it's very difficult to talk about culture at times, because it's things that you understand, but you don't speak about them. You just understand them, right? You interpret them. And so that's a big passion of mine, and why I create content, is because I want to try to reveal the world of culture in a very digestive, easy to understand way. And it's not easy to digest and understand at times, because it's so dynamic, which I've talked about before.
Yeah. So it's a complex one. And like you say, there's always a danger that because we're talking in a kind of fast exchange, the idea is that the nuance that we're not discussing, it seems like we're not aware of it. But actually, if you take the conversation as a whole, then, like I said, some of the most important, inspiring people that I see, Andre, Tyler, etc., they're musicians. Yep,
totally.
Miles Davis. So there's no point in kind of denigrating musicians. They're like, but then even with that, you, like I said, you appreciate them as I do, as philosophers, as creatives, as complete creatives. They're alchemists. They're like literally a basketball player, a golfer, a cricketer. They're challenging lots of preconceptions, and there's a level of bravery and commitment to what they're doing that makes them artists. You know, a Formula One driver, the level of a tennis player, the level of how to put it, resistance you have to get through in order to just to achieve your vision on, you know, whatever that vision is huge. So it's not as if, but what happens is that the idea is they're kind of decontextualized, and all that really counts is how many trophies that they have on their wall or how many, you know, records they've sold. It's not even about that. It's beyond that. It's so much, the influence that they have is so much greater for a lot of us. Like you say, but it is nuanced. It's very difficult to convey that complex level of you know, capacity that they have.
Totally.
We just have to, we appreciate
it. Totally, totally. And I love, honestly, that in the last, this last like 10-minute segment has totally opened my mind up. And I love that because once you kind of think about things in a different way, you can't ever go back to the way you previously thought. Like it challenges these beliefs. I fantastically put. That's just what I'll say, fantastically put. We'll kind of close the chapter on talking about Black Ivy, both metaphorically and verbally. I want to talk to you about a quick few things. We've been talking for a good chunk of time. It's been a great episode, Jason. It's been fantastic. I've loved having you on every minute.
Yeah, thank you, sir.
I have a couple just kind of fun questions. Not so serious stuff. Just fun stuff that we can kind of jump into. You mentioned Tyler, the Creator. I think you've had the opportunity to meet, talk with Tyler, and I don't know your relationship with him at all, but from a person who was a huge fan of Tyler, the Creator, what was it like interacting with him, and what did that mean for you to have, because I know he kind of gave the book a shout out. He respects you a lot. Yeah. What did it kind of mean for you to have the conversations with him?
It meant a hell of a lot, to be honest, because when in writing the book, I had a certain number of people in mind that I was writing for. Literally, these are the people that I'm writing this book for. And, you know, there were guys that I grew up with at school. There were guys who have kids, and I was writing for them in my head. You know, I didn't tell them. They didn't know this. It was just like, okay, this is who I'm voicing this for. This is who I hope this will resonate with. And one of those people were Tyler. And obviously he didn't know that, but I'd always been into Tyler and the whole group from day one, literally. When they came to London, I'm not even sure what year it was, like 2016 or maybe before that. And they did a gig in Shoreditch. Mm. But even before then, you know, Odd Future were, to me, the shit. They were just like, you know, seeing those
dope
kind of clips, yeah, on YouTube, and the whole lot just like completely like super exciting. Mm. So fast forward to, you know, when the book came out, it did relatively well, and I got completely out of the blue a DM from Tyler saying how much he really likes the book, which to me was huge, because it's kind of affirming that the person, one of the people I'd written the book for, you know, it resonated with. And that was kind of like all it meant to me, that actually, yeah, this book is on the right path. And so that was, you know, then that was a really affirming. And then a few months later, and we've been kind of DMing in between, a few months later, he talked about the book on this this interview. And until then, you know, I hadn't reposted anything or whatever. It's like, this is huge and affirming, but this is a guy reading the book. This is not Tyler. This is, so when he did mention it, it was like a super pivotal for the success of the book because so many new people got into it. So it gave it a kind of like another kind of lease of life again. And it continues. And a lot of it is down to Tyler's basically enthusiasm for it. It's huge.
Amazing.
Like enormous.
Amazing.
But he is, you know, super generous and he's just, well, you know.
Yeah, so. I'm a huge fan of Tyler, the creator. I remember, and it's cool that he's had the impact on the book, and it's super cool that you envisioned him reading this book and he actually read it and he likes it. Like, that's incredibly fulfilling. Yeah. That's incredibly fulfilling. I'm a huge fan of Tyler. I love his music, and beyond that, I love his style. I've referenced his style on many occasions in terms of talking about it on YouTube, using him as a style reference. And he's someone in the modern era. He is the modern Miles Davis in a sense where he is pushing the boundaries for what it means to be African-American, what it means to be Black, what it means to have that form of identity. And that's why I resonate with him so much as well. And then the fact that he made such dynamic, awesome music, like that's just icing on the cake, right? So that's really cool to hear you talk about him in that capacity. So I have two more I want to throw at you. One,
I know it was meant to be light.
No, so. No, it's good. Honestly, I'm so glad. I love stories, man. That's the best thing that we can do is tell stories and tell our stories. This is gonna be like, it might be a bad question because it might be obvious, but I wrote it before, obviously, the entire conversation. But which do you prefer in terms of cities? Okay, we're talking New York City. We're talking London. What is the which city is the proverbial best city? Obviously, there's more, but fashion world, culture world. Which city do you like the most? London, New York.
I love them both. But
cop out answer.
It's funny. I had a conversation with somebody over dinner a couple of weeks ago about, you know, whether I like New York or not. And, you know, obviously I love London and I'm a Londoner, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, it's so much bias. It's not fair.
Exactly. I'm being completely objective. The thing is, if I had 2 weeks to spend somewhere, it would be New York.
Mm.
Like, no question. If it was 3 weeks, I couldn't handle New York for 3 weeks. I 2 weeks, and then I have to go somewhere. Even if it's, you know, Miami or LA or the Hamptons, yes. And then come back after a break. Because New York for me is an amazing place, but can be super overwhelming and intense after a period of time. If it came down to spending 6 months in London, perfect. I would love to spend 6 months in London or 3 months in London. 2 weeks is not long enough, but 2 weeks is long enough, and then I have to take a break, come back, because the minute I land in New York, there's this surge of energy that is like I can't maintain for more than 2 weeks, and then I just collapse.
Totally. No, I know exactly. A lot of people burn out in New York after a month because it's just so much. And moving there, living there, there have been a lot of instances. There have been a lot of instances where I've been, man, I'm not going outside. I'm staying in my bed. I'm watching a film. I am relaxing. You're not going to get me out in these streets right now. Like, I just have to take the time for myself. And then the thing about I feel bad about is that everyone under the sun is either visiting or passing through New York. And I mean, it's just tough to always coordinate and have personal time. That's the tough thing. But for London, I'll tell you this, and the people in my life know this. Maybe if you're listening, you know this. I've never been, so I need to experience for myself, you know, what that energy is, what it's like. It's top of list for me, along with Tokyo and other places. And you know, like I told you at the beginning of this podcast, I love traveling. Traveling I think it's one of the best ways to actually like experience a place is being able to go. Obviously, it's a privileged way to do something if you can afford to do so, especially living in America. It's not easy to get overseas because of the cost, but it's up there for me. So I don't have an answer to the question because one of the options I've never been to. So yeah, there's that.
What I would say though about New York is that having been there as a tourist, just on holiday, it's way better to go there if you have something to do, if you're working. Because, like you say, the placement is at such an incredible pace. People don't really have time to stop for you. So unless you've got something going on, you're just moving like half speed, and the whole world is passing you by, and you're missing out on all these kind of really incredible experiences. So I would say if you get a chance to go to New York and do something, even if it's write an article, do a shoot, whatever it is, then I mean that's the reason that's the excuse I would have to go to New York. If I have something to do, I'm there. I'm like the happiest person ever. If there's just purely a holiday, it's really like
How do you
difficult
choose?
because nobody's
Yeah.
stopping. Nobody's gonna
Yeah,
try.
totally. Totally, totally, totally. That's a good point. Good old New York, man. Good old East London too.
Indeed. Indeed.
So we didn't talk about your style as much, like your personal style. But I think of you as someone who is like, I look up to your personal style a lot. Sometimes I look at just images from your Instagram to reference how you style particular things, or like different lookbooks that you're a part of, Sebago or Sebago, or however you pronounce it. I've seen that and just different things that you've done. And I wish we talked more about it, but I think that for right now, we'll table the conversation on this final question. And for me, like, fashion is not always about climbing to improve your style, but for whatever reason, right now I'm in the headspace where, like, oh man, I'm talking to Jason Jules. I gotta ask him. As I forget what I'm gonna ask.
Because in my head, like, don't ask, whatever you do, don't
I
ask.
gotta ask him, what is, and this is like a very cliche question, but I'm gonna ask it. What is your best, capital B, best piece of advice for those who are looking to improve their style in 2024, those including me? How do I improve my style in 2024? What would you say your best piece of advice is for improving style? Think about it, meditate on it.
I think, well, yeah, it's tricky.
Yeah, talk to me.
I actually think that the best way to improve style is to not take it seriously, to play, because it's a creative process. So, it's probably the most democratic creative process ever, because we all have a chance to do it pretty much. So we should enjoy it. That to me, that's the key. And if people who look at you and think, actually, you look ridiculous, maybe in the back of your mind you wanted to look ridiculous. Maybe that's part of the mission. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's play. David Bowie, there's a song, a line by Bowie saying, I couldn't bear to be forgotten. And it's almost like that. It's like sometimes people think, you wear something, it looks great. Sometimes they think you look like crap. Sometimes the person who compliments you is like the worst dressed person ever, so it's not really a compliment. Do you know what I mean? It's like it's all so like complicated and relative. To me, the premise is it's democratic. You have access to it. You should enjoy it. Full stop. And also, personally, no matter what happens during the rest of the day, if I've had a pleasurable period just trying on clothes, putting on clothes, and then leaving the house, then I'm already ahead. Do you know what I mean? I'm already won. So, and it's not about how much money a shirt costs, or how limited edition these kind of sneakers are. It's about this personal story that you're telling and how much pleasure these things give you. So, yeah, I think it's just play, 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 play.
Jason Jules, ladies and
That's it.
gentlemen, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day in Paraguay to hang out with me.
Thank you, sir.
And if people want
You've made my year. You do realize that. I've already kind of, it's only January and I've kind of achieved something that I
Oh,
planned.
stop it.
This is
Stop it.
huge.
Stop it,
Seriously,
man.
this is
Stop
like,
it.
I don't
Stop it.
know what I'm going to do
Stop
now.
it. You're gonna do bigger and better things, man. I already know you're an inspiration to a lot of us, and by a lot of us, I just mean people who care about fashion. And it was cool to chat about you and or chat about you, chat with you, and hang out and do these kind of things. And it's just a pleasure, true pleasure. Where can people find out about you if they want to see Instagram, Black Ivy, those kind of things? Because I know you're doing some special things with Black Ivy right now. No.
Yeah. We're doing, we have a series of t-shirts, which we actually launched with Drake's, one of these. Nice. And we're going to kind of put them onto our store, which is Garmsville Concept Store. Again, you know, it's a play thing. We do very small runs of things, and then sometimes you'll see there's nothing on the shop. Sometimes there'll be tons of stuff on the shop. So we're doing a rerun of these t-shirts that we found kind of in the back of a cupboard in Drake's. And I don't know what else I'm doing, to be honest. Looking at doing kind of digital magazines just for the hell of it. Doing quite a few collaborations with people, which, you know, hopefully you'll find out about at some point. Like looking at shoes and sneakers and socks and stuff. So yeah, we're doing, you know, I think one of the things that I'm into right now is kind of, I know, just like, well, I guess I've always been into working with people I like. That's pretty much it. So this year is going to be more of that. Last year was doing a lot of the exhibition. That was really satisfying, but it was like an enormous project. And this year, the goal is to do lots of kind of super creative, fun projects that we can just wear and play with.
Beautiful, man. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Well, thank you so much.
And you, what are you planning? I mean, we can edit this out.
No, I mean, keep it in.
If you want to
edit it out. Honestly, I don't care. Yeah. People just like...
I'm super curious.
For me, this year, when people ask me how I, like, what do I plan to do this year? What do you have big going on? It's always a kind of weirdly tough question. Because for me, my number one goal as a creative is to create. So my goal every day, every week is to create. And I can't tell you what opportunities are like specifically down the pipeline. I have the goals, the companies, the conversations like yourself that I have like in the back of my planner, literally right here. I have this thing that I like write everything in that I want to do. And I like you were a goal that I had to be on the podcast for a long time now, actually. And in fact, a bit of like talking about Black Ivy, getting into Black Ivy is not a master plan, but I've kind of been like ever since I started getting into like learning like deeply about Japanese Americana and denim, like I just saw this clear path of there's so many different avenues I could take. And that's important for me. Like that's where I want to take the content. I want to have more discussions about Black Ivy, videos, creating all these things. So for me, the biggest goal, week in, week out, day in, day out, just stay happy with creating. And I'm in a beautiful place with it right now. Like I just love conversations. I love talking about fashion, and for whatever that brings me, good, bad, indifferent. Like I'm glad I'm here on the journey of what I've started for myself, which I started back in 2020, talking about fashion. So. That's cliche. It's a bit corny, but that's where I'm at for 2024.
That sounds perfect to me.
That's where I'm at.
Perfect. Have you read Amatora?
Yes.
Or have you come across?
Yes. Amatora? It's.
Have you interviewed
literally over there?
David Marks.
No, David Marks would be like another fantastic person to interview. He's got the source. He is the source.
He is so heavy. It's ridiculous. It's like so. Yeah, you have to. I will
parlay, my friend.
Definitely. Any questions?
For sure.
That's huge. I cannot wait to see you two have a conversation.
That would be awesome.